you have to also ask yourself, how important is it for me to stay sober? How important, how valuable is your sobriety to you? Because if it's not valuable, then you're going to slip back into it, back into drinking, fairly quickly. If it's valuable to you and it's something that you cherish like a treasure, then, you know, nobody's going to take that away from you.
Recovery in Real Life Podcast, episode number 6. Stay tuned. You are not going to want to miss this episode. Hey, everybody. Welcome into the podcast. It's Bruce Roberts. Our guest on the show today is Anthony Garcia. I hope that name rings a bell. I hope that name rings a big bell. Anthony Garcia is the super talented musician who, out of the kindness of his heart, has donated his original music to help underscore the Recovery in Real Life podcast. I've known Anthony for a couple of years now, and I attribute the talks that I've had with him to setting me on the path to sobriety. I'll talk more about that at the end of the show, but for now, here's the incredible interview with Anthony Garcia. All right. Anthony, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, good. How's the work on the new house going? Anthony just bought a new home. Anthony and his new bride bought a new home built in 1914. Is that right?
Yes, it's built in 1914. And yeah, we're doing a lot of renovations. I was just up there all day yesterday and all day today, and it's quite a bit of work. We're just, demolishing some ceilings and walls to put in pipes, and then going to seal them back up. And it's going to be a big project, but it's been a lot of fun, and have some friends helping me out. So,
okay,
that know and what they're doing.
Yeah, have y'all moved in there yet, or not yet?
No, we're still living in Georgetown in my wife's house that she bought before we even met. And she's sold this house. We're staying here for a couple more months. And then until we hopefully get the other house livable. And once that happens, then we'll be moving into that house.
Right on.
So we're kind of leasing back right now from the new owner of the house that we're currently living.
Gotcha.
So that's kind of
pretty common in the real estate game, I think.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, as I said in the intro, Anthony and I have been friends for a couple of years now, and I recently learned about Anthony's story and his sober journey. But before we get into that, Anthony, let's just start at the beginning and just kind of introduce yourself. Tell us who you are, where you are, and what you do for a living, and all that good stuff.
Well, my name is Anthony Garcia. I'm a musician. I play music full-time in the Central Texas area. I've lived in Austin for the past couple of years. I play in Austin and the Hill Country area. For those in the Central Texas area, there's Highway 290, which goes westward out from Austin. And I play, there's a ton of breweries and wineries, and I play at several of those in that part of the state. And that's what I do full time. And I've I've been a teacher and all sorts of things, and decided in about 2013 that I would just play music. I didn't want a boss anymore and would just play music and see how that went. And I'm still doing that.
Right on. And I can tell everybody from personal experience, you made the right decision. I mean, I never saw you teach, but I've certainly seen you play, and it's amazing.
Well, thank you.
So I want to get to your story, but something you just said about playing in, you know, the honky tonks and bars in Central Texas, what is your sort of strategy for dealing with, not drinking while you're playing in these places, and maybe talk a little bit about how you handle that?
At this point in my life, it's not a problem at all. Doesn't even cross my mind to play. Obviously I see people, I guess once you've made that decision to quit or to not partake of alcohol anymore, or to not have that be a part of your life and everything that entails psychologically, Watching people do that in moderation or in excess in whatever capacity they partake in that, it doesn't really impact you. And it's interesting to observe people doing that. I kind of see it now as more of observing, you know, animals in nature. It's kind of like that for me now. It's sort of less like, it's interesting to see that people spend their time in that way. And I'm not doing it in a judgmental way. I mean, I don't judge in the way what anybody does with their money or with their time, but it's just interesting. It's interesting to see that, wow, you know, a lot of our culture revolves around alcohol, and not necessarily, you know, not getting wasted or abusing it, but it's just centered around it. I mean, it's social. Yeah. It's something that people do to relax. Some people do it excessively, but you know, it's just interesting to observe that. So when I'm playing, since I don't drink, I can remember my gigs, and I feel like I play better sober. Whereas, you know, previously I felt that I played better while I was drinking, and I didn't sound better because I heard recordings of myself playing while I was drunk, and it was terrible. And it was really shocking and appalling to me when I heard some of those recordings and videos. So it seldom crosses my mind when I'm playing a show. It feels like I'm just playing for people who are enjoying music. And, it's not a problem or a temptation for me in that way. It's more of I get to observe kind of people and how they interact with each other and how they act when they're consuming alcohol, yeah. You know, in that environment.
You probably see that change as the show goes on and as the night goes on, I would imagine.
You know,
behavior in people.
It's interesting. It's sort of like being able to tell how old someone is. I'm a really horrible judge of age, and I'm also, in that analogy, I'm also terrible at realizing how drunk someone is, because someone will come up and talk to me and they all seem sober to me, and a friend will come over and be like, man, that person's wasted. Mm. You know, and I'm really a horrible judge at that. I mean, there are some people who are obviously, who get drunk, or get you know, noticeably drunk. But for the most part, I can't really tell, when people are drunk or not, ironically, because I used to get pretty drunk. Maybe some people can hide it, because I know I used to be able to hide it real well.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. Oh yeah. I became an expert at hiding it. As I've said on the show numerous times, and that was what, for me, like that, excuse me, that's what got to me, was the hiding it.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the lying about it. That for me was my rock bottom. I just couldn't deal with the guilt anymore, let alone what it was doing to me and my health and my job and all that stuff. So, cool. Well, I would love for folks to hear your story. And maybe just, you know, sort of take us back to when you started drinking and, you know, maybe go, you know, forward, you know, however you want, tell your story and when it became a problem, when you decided to quit, how you quit, and how it's been going since then.
Well, I started drinking in high school, and you know, that's pretty normal. And it was pretty manageable with occasional binge drinking, but you know, at parties with friends, until I was about 27. And when I was about 27, 28, I, you know, started drinking every day. And it would be like when I got home from work, or it would be going to meet friends, you know, for happy hour or whatever. I seldom would drink while I was playing. It started to become a problem around when I was 30, and I was incidentally going through the last year of my first marriage during my 30th year. So there were a lot of personal things that were happening, and it was a way for me to escape. I really started staying out later after gigs on weeknights. After 2 a.m., there would always be an after party, or I would find the after party. And I'd come home, of course, drunk at like 5 a.m. and crash out in my music room because we were no longer sleeping in the same room. That may or may not sound familiar to people who have gone through separations and divorces, but that's what happened in ours. And so that's when it started. And I started hanging around with people that were much younger than me, that were about 10 to 12 years younger than me, who were you know, so they were in their 20s, partying, college kids. And that was through playing music and hanging out. And so that's when it started to become a problem. And after my divorce, which was in 2006, that was what started pretty much drinking heavily on a regular basis. And I mean, probably, you know, at that point was like three times a week blackout drunk, you know? So that was kind of the beginning, was when I was about 30, which was around 2005, 2004. And then I moved, in 2009, I moved to South Korea, and I was an English teacher, in South Korea for 4 years, because I was playing bars almost seven nights a week in Texas. And I could see the pattern that was happening even back then. I was drinking a lot. I was staying out past last call. I was having people come over to my house, and we were having after parties over there. It was just constant drinking, constant playing music. And plus I was a smoker at the time, so I was smoking too. And it was just, I couldn't see an end to this pattern that was happening. And I didn't feel like I was growing musically. I didn't feel like I was doing really my best. I was just playing in bars until 2 a.m. And so I was like, you know, I'm going to put a personal challenge to myself. I'm going to give myself a trial by fire, which I do occasionally. And I decided that I was going to move to Asia, and it ended up being Korea, South Korea. My girlfriend at the time, I told her she could, that's what I was going to do, and she could come with me or she could stay in Texas. And excuse me, my dog's playing with a toy. Let me get it from him.
No problem.
Might want to edit that.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, we got to keep it real.
Sorry. So in my mind, moving to South Korea was going to be, I envisioned myself, you know, going to Buddhist temples and meditating, teaching elementary English, going home at 4 every day, and, you know, reading and going to bed early and leading a sober life. That's what I envisioned, and that's what I wanted going over. And quitting playing music live. I didn't want to play music live. I just wanted to get away and go for a year and live over there. And
why Asia?
Because I'd never been there before. So I had lived in Europe. I had lived in Europe. I'd lived in Germany. And I speak German also. I learned German while I was there, studied it, traveled all over Europe. I traveled extensively over Europe. So I kind of wanted to have that same experience in Asia. So I just decided that I wanted to move to Asia. And that's why. I'd never been there. I'd never been there. So why not?
Why not?
There, yeah. And teach and live. Yeah. And incidentally, my girlfriend at the time was also a musician, and she was my duo partner. So, she was down, and she was down to move. So we did. And we were both like, you know, on the same page as far as taking a break for a year and kind of just trying to sober up and kind of, you know, get zen with ourselves. Within 4 days of moving to South Korea, we had our first gig. It's like a drug. It sounds like a heroin addict. This is going to sound exaggerated or conceited, but this is actually what happened. The scene in, after our first gig, everyone in our town, it was an 8 million person town. It's called Busan, South Korea. And within that population of Korea, or that overall population, there's a smaller expat population of English teachers that was probably about 10,000 people. So you have a small Western town, and Western meaning, you know, Canadian, West English speaking people from English speaking countries. You have a community of about 10,000 people who are just starved for anything Western. Meaning,
oh, okay. Okay.
Food, music, just anything that has to do with that to remind them of their home culture, because living in Asia, as you can imagine, living in South Korea, as you can imagine, is actually the complete opposite of anything that we're used to in our Western cultures. So when we went over, you know, we're two musicians that went over who in the U.S. had not done it as a hobby. We were doing music as for a professional. And so, you know, we were maybe a step above what you might get in an expat bar in South Korea. So word spread quickly that we were there. And within a very short time, we were getting all kinds of gigs and playing luck like we were back home. We're playing, you know, definitely right. Fridays and Saturdays, if not also Thursday nights. And so, you know, the quitting music part of moving to Asia just kind of went out the window. It just, that was not going to happen. We played, we probably got involved more in the live music scene than we planned on. And so that meant more time in bars. And what that also meant, spending time in bars in South Korea, it's even, I'll quote one of my friends who lived over there who said that South Korea is a Disneyland for alcoholics.
Oh, wow. I hadn't heard that before.
It's, and that's putting it mildly. Okay. So from the expat culture perspective, going to South Korea, there's no last call. So there's no 2 o'clock, the lights come on. The bars stay open as long as there's people there spending money. And it doesn't even matter if it's five people, which I spent many a night there until 9 a.m. with five people, or oh, even, wow. even two people. So there's no last call. There's also no public intoxication law. So you can walk out and fall on the street. You can even sleep on the street. Many people do, many Koreans. Mm, wow. And just passed out, men in business suits passed out on the street, girls mm-hmm. in dresses, you know, passed out because they got so drunk. And thankfully it's a safe culture there. People don't steal and rob generally speaking, not like, you know, you would expect maybe in a country like the US. Right. So there's no drinking, there is no public intoxication, there's no last call. And in fact, the amount of alcohol you can consume is sort of a social, it has a bearing on your social status, especially in a professional setting. So oftentimes you'll see businessmen go to have dinners and they'll, you know, get drunk. There's a whole ritual behind the drinking culture in Korea. The way that when you're seated at a table, it's a very Confucian culture over there. So age is very important. So the youngest person is designated to make sure that nobody else's glasses are empty, which is, of course, dangerous because that means all the glasses are constantly full. And it's nobody's fault because that's the youngest person's duty and the youngest person is doing their job by keeping everybody's cups full. And then there's this – so that's part of it. And you're encouraged to drink and you're encouraged to refuse a drink from an elder, or a shot, is disrespectful. So being given a shot from an elder person is considered an honor. And by a shot, yeah. What I mean is there's an alcohol in Korea that is similar to sake. It's, you know, as far as its role, sake being, you know, a rice liquor that is, you know, it's consumed warm or it's consumed cold. It's kind of a sophisticated Japanese alcoholic drink. Well, in South Korea, it's not as sophisticated. It comes in green bottles and it's basically paint thinner.
Okay.
It costs $1 a bottle at the grocery store, at the convenience store. So that is at the Korean meals, you'll have a barbecue cooking a grill in the middle of the table. I'm sure many people are familiar with that. While the youngest person is designated to cook that meat, the older people are sitting around talking and drinking and giving shots. There are little shot glasses that accompany whatever other beverage you might be having, which is typically beer. And shots are being, you know, poured for one another, two at a time. And then people are cheersing and you know, drinking together the entire time. And that's dinner. And then you go, of course, after that, you go to the karaoke bar and you drink more there. And then after the wow. karaoke bar, you go out later and drink, eat noodles and you drink more. And that might be a Tuesday night, you know, or a Monday night.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And that's pretty, again, my point with all that is that was the culture that I went into to try to wean myself and back away from drinking a little bit. And just, and that Korean drinking culture permeates and crosses over into the expat culture. And you could, expat culture in South Korea, at least when I was living there, was pretty much a perpetual spring break. There was always a reason to drink. There was always a reason to party. And your average drinker was probably your borderline alcoholic here in the United States. That was your average drinker. your average drinker there.
Wow.
Then you had your real alcoholics, your severe alcoholics who needed intervention, who would drink in the morning when they woke up. Sometimes they would even drink while they were teaching their jobs. They would hide it in their coffee cup. I mean, there were people with problems there, and there were, you know.
Yeah. You don't hear about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, in 1 year, I guess I should add, 1 year turned into 4 years for me. I mean, we're having such a great time. We made great friends. And that was something that didn't change after 1 year. I mean, it continued. And, you know, that you're right. It is something that you don't necessarily hear about. I guess it's something you wouldn't really know about unless you spent time there. And, you know, not drinking there for a night is really hard. Staying in, I mean, that's,
yeah,
you know, there's always a party going on, and there's always and that's not to judge anyone being over there. I mean, that's just the way it is. And I still keep in touch with a lot of my friends. I'm 47 now, and a lot of my friends that I still keep in touch with are my age over there. And a lot of them have, you know, they've gotten married and have kids now, and a lot of them don't even go out anymore. A lot of them have just stopped and just kind of tried to stay away from hardcore drinking. Some of them continue to drink as much as they did. You know, some of them are still on that path.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
So no, I was just going to ask, it doesn't sort of die out with age. It sounds like maybe for a few people, but
I think you have to make a real concerted effort to get away from drinking over there.
Okay.
I'm sure there are some people that can still go out and hang out and not drink, but I couldn't imagine that. It's just so embedded in the life, especially in the expat life, you know? I mean, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that was 2006-ish, 2005. And that.
So I lived in Korea from 2009 to 2013.
Okay. Okay.
And I came back. I should add just real quick, quickly, I should add that the reason I moved back from South Korea, I moved back for the same reason I had gone there, because I needed to. I knew I had to get away from drinking. I had to get away from the drinking and the excessive drinking. There's no way I could have known it was going to be like that. And I had a great time. Those are some of the best years of my life, and some of my greatest friends I have still keep in touch with, and I met over there. And I wouldn't change it for anything. What I did, the way I lived my life over there. And it was hard, but you know, I did it, and I had so much fun. I got to see so much of the world and meet great people and have made albums over there. I had time and money to record albums, and it was wonderful. But I knew I had a university job where I worked 10 hours a week and got 5 months paid vacation. I mean, it was basic. It's in black and white on paper, it was a great life. But I knew that I wasn't going to go anywhere. I mean, I wasn't going to, my English teaching career certainly wasn't going to.
Yeah. Know, what about take your music off and, career? Did that seem like it could go somewhere over there?
Not really. I probably could have continued. I did get to play all over South Korea, and that was a lot of fun. Never played in Japan. Did some very small impromptu gigs in Thailand. But, you know, it was never. I did get to record quite a bit, and we had some amazing shows, and we helped build up a pretty big scene in those 4 years, and had an amazing music and art scene in that town. That's also something you don't hear about. There's a real art scene and music scene over in South Korea, especially in in Seoul, of course, but in Busan, spelled Busan, in the southernmost part of the South Korean peninsula. There's really, they've made a lot of headway in art and music. Also a lot of, expats have opened up some small businesses and restaurants and things like that over there. But, as far as that goes, you know, I had that experience of getting, to be able to record and be creative. So in that regard, yeah, I feel like I was successful as far as, but I missed Texas, and South Korea is a very small, geographically small country, and I missed road trips, and I missed, you know, being able to drive around and you know, those kinds of things.
Are you Texas native?
Yes.
Okay. Where were you born?
I was born in Irving, in the Dallas area.
Okay.
But I grew up in Lubbock, Texas, which is in the West.
Yeah.
So I grew up out there, and lived there, you know, from the time I was four until I graduated. Well, until about in 2009. But I lived in other parts of the world, and I lived in New York City for a while, and I lived in Dallas, back in Dallas for a while. So I've kind of, you know, used that as a home base. My mom lives there still, and I have a lot of friends that live there. But that was where I grew up, and that's home for me, is Lubbock.
Nice. So back in the States now, how are things going for you then?
So moved back.
Or back in Texas, yeah.
Moved back to Texas in 2013. And like I said before, I decided I didn't want to have a boss or a job, quote unquote. So I decided that I was going to just play music. By this time, I had a different girlfriend, and she was also a musician, a violinist. And that's when we moved to Austin. traveled to Europe a little bit and, you know, all that. Traveled to Europe a couple of times and played over there. But moved down to Austin and made that change. So as far as, you know, I guess how this fits into maybe drinking, the funny thing is it's sort of like a speed trap, you know, when you're going, let's say you're going 75 miles to 80 miles an hour down the highway, and you come to a small town, and the speed limit suddenly turns to 40 miles an hour, you have to slam the brakes on. And if you don't, you're just going to kind of keep going, maybe hurt someone, maybe get a ticket. Well, that was my experience moving back to the United States, because I was still going at South Korea drinking speed. And okay. I moved back to the US where there's actually rules here, and there's actually, you know, there's a last call here, and there are drunken intoxication. There's public intoxication laws, and you can't just, you know, go screaming mad and cussing your friends out and pushing each other around and actually getting in fights. You know, there were a lot of fights over in South Korea. I mean, physical fights. I mean, that's a whole other podcast.
Okay.
But, you know, yeah. It's a lot more tame here. It's funny to me, if I could pause for a second. It's funny to me when I hear an American say that there's a drinking culture here, because this is nothing. It's nothing here.
Well, that's what that was my point earlier. Like, I had no idea about the drinking culture in South Korea compared to here.
Yeah. It's completely different. So coming back here was a big shift for me, and I didn't want to slow down. I wasn't going to slow down. I was going full speed, and I was just making it work. I was making it happen, and I was just, you know, the wheels were about to fall off the train, and I was keeping it going somehow. And so that happened. That happened for a while, and then about 2016, the girlfriend that I was with, she just one day she this wasn't her, and she wasn't being manipulative. This was not typical of her, but I was sitting on the bed around noon, just, you know, on my phone or reading, and she came in there and she was bawling, and she was just like, I don't know why you drink so much. I don't know why you're doing this to yourself. You're a beautiful person. You're talented and you're smart. And I don't understand. I don't understand. I can't stand to see you do this to yourself. She wasn't asking me to quit. She wasn't giving me an ultimatum. It was just, I saw myself through someone else's eyes, and it was a wake up call to me, and it really shocked me. There's a program here in Austin called HAM, which is a musician's, it's a program for musicians who need, you know, medical insurance, dental care, but there's also counseling, and, you know, for psychological reasons and for substance abuse. So I sought out a counselor and in 2016 and started going to one-on-one sessions. And in 2016, I quit for a year and a half, and I felt really great. And that was the first time I'd ever really quit drinking for that long. And I felt really proud of myself. And that lasted until December of 2018. It was wonderful, and I didn't know how long it was going to last and all that, but it was good, and went to some sessions, went through a lot. I mean, I went through, so that girlfriend and I broke up, and I went through a breakup. I went through a big couple of life changes, and I didn't drink, you know, I stayed strong. But you know, I eventually, of course, started drinking again, and that was, you know,
Before you get into that, though, sorry, what kind of help did you get? What did Ham do for you?
Well,
how did they help you quit?
Well, you know, I guess logistically, or just, I guess if we're speaking about, kind of from a basic level, they made it affordable. So my sessions ended up, I think they were normally $100 for a one-on-one session with an alcohol counselor, an independent alcohol counselor. And I was only paying like $10. So they subsidized quite a bit of it, or maybe it was my insurance. I don't remember, but it didn't cost me a lot of money to do that. They facilitated that, and they made it easy for me. I think they kind of just put me in touch with a certain insurance provider or something. I don't remember exactly because it was several years ago, but they facilitated that and they put me in contact with a counselor. I went to the counselor, and our sessions were good. He was a great guy, and he really gave me some good tips on how to, not necessarily how to stay sober, but just kind of gave me a place to talk about it. So that's kind of how they helped. They kind of facilitated putting me in touch with the right people.
So year and a half, and then December 2018, what happened?
I'm sorry, maybe that's wrong. That was December of 2017. That was 2017. Okay. So now I was on third girlfriend, if you're keeping up.
Okay.
If you're keeping count.
Keeping a tally sheet. No, it's all right.
So at this point in my life, I'm on a cruise ship. I've been playing cruise ships because I broke up with the previous girlfriend. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go play on cruise ships and just get away again. Me getting away. me trying to clear my head, not escaping, but just trying to get in a space where I can just be alone and kind of figure things out, figure out what the next move is. So while I was figuring out my next move, I was on cruise ships. And at this particular point, I was in Hawaii, and I was playing on cruise ships on a ship out there. And we would hit all of the islands in a 7-day itinerary. And this third girlfriend, we had arranged for her to come out and be with me for Christmas and New Year's. And it was a great, we had tickets were paid for. I had the arrangements. I was going to borrow someone's car to go get her at the airport. Everything was going. All the logistics were in place. And of course, we had a fight the day before she was supposed to arrive. And she told me in a text that she wasn't coming. Like the day I was on my way to go get her at the airport. She's like, I never got on the plane. I'm sorry.
Wow.
So that was fine. The thing that made it really hard was the cabin next to me was having a Christmas party that night, and they wanted to use my cabin for the overflow of people because it was right next door. I had a large cabin as I was, the piano player, and the musicians for some reason got extra large cabins. So I was like, sure. So in other words, I couldn't exactly close my door and hide and watch a movie, and
Right.
And I kind of just said, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to just have a glass of wine, And you know how that turns out.
Yep.
I got so drunk. It was one of those where I woke up the next day and I was like, I had to go to people, and I was like, what did I do last night? I had people that had never spoken to me before. Like, dude, it was fun last night. High five. I was like, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's when I started drinking again. And, so that was the end of 2017 going into 2018 for anyone keeping score, or keeping track. And just a side note, when you quit for such a long time and you go back to drinking, it's for me anyways, and I've seen this pattern in others, it really hits you harder.
It hits you harder. Yeah, it does.
Because not only because it was something that was missing from your life physically, a chemical that was missing from your life, or in a habit, but you add to that the shame and the disappointment that you feel in yourself, and it's how it's compounded because you let yourself down. And so I guess the screw it mentality is just there. And it's just like, you know what, man, if I'm going to go, I'm going to go really super hard, and I don't care, because I'm just so sad and disappointed that I miss this. And hey, you know what? I can do what I want. I can drink as often as I want. I can drink whenever I want to. I can go to the bar at 2 PM if I want to and drink. No, who's going to stop me? I'm an adult.
Yeah.
And that's the mentality. So the responsibility, or the responsible voice in your mind kind of gets put on, put on mute for a little while, a little easier. Yeah,
the excuses start and the justifications start. Yeah, it sounded like you were living the movie The Hangover there on the cruise ship.
Yeah, well, that was Korea. The cruise ships, yeah. Ships were sort of like a little more tame, but they had pretty strict rules about, you know, you couldn't get too, if you're going to get drunk, you had to get drunk in your room, and you couldn't go walking around the passengers drinking. You couldn't even go under the crew, where the crew lived and the crew bars. You had to be real, especially on the ship in Hawaii, because you had to have special credentials to be on there. It's a whole process that you had to go through to even go there. But you had to get essentially what was a Coast Guard passport, and you had to go through a week's worth of training to get that, take tests, take fire safety, first aid. You had to go through this whole process. So you got this red passport, and that was a merchant mariner's license or certificate just to be a crew member, just to play, just to wash dishes or play piano or, whatever. So if you were, and at any moment you could be randomly breathalyzed. And if you had, I can't remember, it was so low. It was like, I mean, what is the legal limit is 0.08 in Texas. So it was like 0.04. At any moment they could randomly breathalyze you. And if you had any alcohol or you had a low alcohol amount of alcohol in your system, you were immediately fired. And you had that certificate revoked, which was the equivalent of receiving a DWI. Mm-hmm. It went on your record.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So they were real strict about drinking there. That doesn't mean people didn't drink and get drunk. That just means they had to be careful about not getting caught. Yeah. And you could only have a certain amount of alcohol in your cabin. You could only have a six pack of beer, or you could only have either a six pack of beer or a bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. And they would do random cabin checks and come into your cabin and they could search all. Yeah.
I guess that's good. Right. I mean, it makes sense when you think about it.
So it wasn't a free for all really.
Right.
They were very, very strict. And, anyways, I kind of, finished that started my drinking again. And, I got off of cruise ships and went back to playing music back in Texas. And,
do you feel like part of, once you slipped up, do you feel like part of your justification for drinking or the reason for drinking or the reason why you drank was to cover up the guilt?
Oh yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Certainly. Yeah. It was to, it was twofold. It was to cover up the guilt, and also the other side would be to kind of a middle finger to the side of you that was telling you you couldn't do something, or the discipline side of yourself. You know, it's just like, I had rules before, and rules are meant to be broken, so I'm going to break them and just do what I want to do. Nobody's going to tell me. Nobody can stop me because I can do whatever I want. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, and you were single, right, at the time.
Yeah, I had a girlfriend. No, I actually had a girlfriend during that time. That single part didn't come for another year.
Okay.
And that was, God, that was insane.
Tell us about some of that.
Well, so I ended up, broke up with, my girlfriend, that girlfriend and I broke up in October of 2018. And that gave me about 9 months of single life. And, so October of 2018, I broke up with her, and incidentally, November of 2018, a month later, on Thanksgiving weekend, I actually got a DWI here in Austin. And, so that kind of, coincided with my single life. The DWI didn't stop me from drinking, though.
Yeah.
It just delayed it, because a year later is when I got sober this time. I got my DWI in 2018, and I quit drinking for about 3 months because I just knew I had always told myself, if I ever get a DWI, I'm done drinking. That's it. But it, in my mind, I knew I wasn't done drinking, and I just knew it was just going to delay it for a little bit, which it did. So February 2019, I started drinking heavily again. That was during my single life. And that was, you know, you're drinking heavily. And when you're drinking heavily and you're playing music at bars and there's girls there and you're feeling confident. And, I ended up, and I hadn't really been single for any extended period of my life. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to be single for a real long time. And,
right.
You know, you add into that, you know, meeting different girls and juggling different girls and lying to different girls and lying to yourself and, you know, having several girlfriends at the same time who don't know about each other and mm-hmm. Having to coordinate so they don't overlap. It's just like a part-time, it's like another part-time job. And, that got real exhausting. And, so that it was just chaos. It was chaos. I look back on that part of my life and I really feel shame for that. I feel shame for, you know, the people that are hurt in that way. But anyways, I got off on a little tangent on that, but, I guess it was during that year and during that time that I was, you know, spring of 2018, and into the summer of 2018 that I knew that I needed to quit. And, incidentally, the summer of 2019, I went over to Germany and I was playing. I went over there for, I went over there for about 6 weeks and played music in the Bavaria area and the Black Forest and then up in Berlin and Hamburg and, went down to Italy to meet some friends. And, it's interesting because during that time I was keeping track of how many days I was drinking and how many sober days I had. And out of those 6 weeks, I think I had like 10 days that I didn't drink, like maybe. And that was only because I had drank so much the previous days that I couldn't even stand the sight of alcohol. I mean, I couldn't look at alcohol.
Well, I was going to say 10 days and six out of 6 weeks, that's not bad. But if it's because you're so sick from the night before, that's a different story.
Yeah. Well, not just the night before, but the 3 days before.
Got it.
It was... I mean, I could tell you stories, but you know, I mean, I was in Berlin and I remember specifically that I started drinking on a Wednesday night. And again, there's no late night curfews there. So you could go to the 3 a.m, you can go to the convenience store down the street and just sit there buy a lot of beer and just sit there and drink. And I would, and cause I was 7 hours ahead of the US, I would call my quote unquote different girlfriends back in the US and talk to them in their evening time while I was drinking. Or talk to some other friends. So I would stay up drinking. And I remember one Wednesday I spent at a convenience store. Thursday, somebody had a house party and I went over and played piano and we'd drink until, again, it was a convenience store night. Friday night, I met a friend of mine who I'd met in South Korea and we partied we drank all day. And I drank until like 4 or 5 a.m. Saturday, I woke up with the shakes and I met another friend and we drank. And then I had a gig that night And then I had to fly to Italy, so I didn't sleep that night. I just drank all night and got on the plane, got to the airport at 6 a.m. and cracked open some wine and drank the entire time, drank until I arrived in Italy at about 9 a.m. And my friends met me there. It was a Sunday and we drank all day on Sunday. So it was kind of a typical week, like a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Right.
And then I wake up on Monday and I'm like, I can't look at alcohol. I can't look at it. I don't ever want to drink again.
Right.
So it wouldn't be like one night. It would be several nights of heavy, heavy drinking. And, I knew at that point, I was like, I've got to quit for at least a year. So that's the deal I made with myself. I was like, I'm going to quit for a year. And I'm good at when I say I'm going to do something, I do it. I know that about I can say that about myself. So, that leads me to this current period of sobriety. And I got sober November 4th, 2019. So that was about 2 months, 2 years and 3 months ago.
Right.
So I just said I would do it for a year. And of course, leading up to that year of quitting, I drank more. I drank as much as I possibly could because I was going to quit for a year.
Right.
And that was pretty insane and, you know, led to a lot of crazy drunken nights. And but here I am, and I quit on November 4th. And after about a week of sobriety, I decided, I was like, man, this is, I don't want to drink ever again. I mean, this is like drinking, doing this to myself is pointless. And I still feel the same way. And I should also add that I got married, about 9 months ago, and my wife also said she wanted to quit with me on November 4th of 2019. And, so we quit at the same time, and she's also sober. So, for the same amount of time, and it makes it a lot easier, I want to say, to have a partner who is also sober, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. My wife is one of those weird ones who can take it or leave it and has no problem walking away from it. So I've had, you know, since I decided, you know, 3 months ago to give it, you know, to stop, she's like, okay. And I'm like, oh, you're so weird. How can you just say, okay?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I know those people too. My wife, however, is not one of those people. She also was a, you know, borderline, you know, heavy drinker. Uh-huh. And she'd always wanted to quit. She'd tried to, she was like me. She'd tried and she'd quit and she'd not been able to.
Yeah.
She had quit trying to quit. So she was very excited when I told her that I was quitting for a year, and she was like, I'm up for that challenge. And, you know, there are days where we'll just be driving down the road and she'll just say, I'm so glad I don't drink anymore. And we'll just tell each other stories about, you know, our life and how hard it was and just how thankful we are that we, you know, quitting something like that, when you stop destroying yourself and hurting yourself intentionally and stop, you know, living your life with a ball and chain wrapped, or, you know, with a anvil tied around your ankle and you're trying to swim in the ocean. You develop a lot of wonderful traits and a lot of new perspective. And one of those is gratitude. I mean, being grateful for life, being grateful for the gifts you've been given. I mean, when you're destroying yourself, you're not showing gratitude. You're taking things for granted. And I feel shameful for that, you know, that I did that to myself and to the universe or to God or, you know, whatever you want to call it. But I'm thankful that I'm not doing that anymore to myself and to others, you know, because others can see that. Others can see, even though you try to hide it, others can see.
And you think they can't.
Right.
Because if you think you're being so clever and hiding it and lying about it. And it's just, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's just a big lie. So you just quit. You just said, that was it. I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah. I just quit. I didn't go to counseling. I didn't do anything like that. I didn't take any pills. I just told myself I didn't want to do it anymore. And I stopped. And, you know, my main thing is I just wanted to start being honest with myself, like you said, you know, and, being able to look at myself in the mirror and say, I'm proud of myself and I'm happy, you know.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that for so long. I couldn't do that. I kind of would laugh at myself if I tried to do that, you know.
Yeah.
Now I can do that now. I can look at myself and say, I'm proud of you and I'm, you know, I love you. I can tell myself that. I mean, this sounds like some Stuart Smalley stuff from Saturday Night Live, but no, I mean it's you know, as cliche and as it sounds and trite as it sounds, self-love is important. It's not easy to come by. I don't think everybody can say that they love themselves, not in an arrogant or narcissistic or conceited way or anything self-centered way, but to really genuinely love who you are. I think most people kind of despise ourselves in some way. Some of us, you know, not everyone, but you know, I would say on average, it's a pretty big percentage of people who don't like themselves. Or something about themselves, maybe.
Yeah, and that contributes to the drinking problems.
Or other problems.
That we have. You know. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, Anthony, you have an amazing story, and you obviously have some inherent strength, internal strength, to quit and to stay sober for you know, several periods for very long times, and now for over 2 years. What advice do you have for people who are out there struggling and know that they need to do something, they want to quit? And you just talked about some of it, but maybe, you know, what would you do if somebody like me mm-hmm. came to you, which I did, and I mm-hmm. attribute my sobriety quite a bit to the talks that we've had. Mm-hmm. But what advice would you pass on to somebody who is struggling?
Well, I would say, first of all, recognize why do you have this habit and why are you doing this to yourself? Maybe take a step back and say, you know, what's the reason? What's the psychological reason, first of all? And second of all, do you have a chemical addiction? Because some people have a chemical addiction to alcohol. Right. I mean, some people have a psychological addiction to it. Some people have both, I think. I mean, I'm not a trained therapist. But I'm just basing this off my observation and my observing myself and others who have had problems. And I would say, first of all, if you have a chemical addiction, like you wake up in the morning and you crave this, or you cannot exist without alcohol, then that's, you got to seek some kind of other help. I mean, you can't just quit. I mean, you've got to seek some professional help with that. Medical people, someone who can help you with that, how your body is going to physically react to taking a chemical away like that. Because your body can react, you know, negatively. And you can die. Yeah. You can die.
Yes. Yes.
I've known that. I've seen people have severe reactions. On the other side of it, you realize the psychological factors. Like, you know, do you want to quit? You, first of all, should be the question that you ask yourself. Do you really want to quit? Or are you saying you want to quit? Because if you really want to quit, then you're going to make a plan. No, you know, no matter how great or how small the plan is, but you're going to make a plan. And you're going to, if you really want to quit and the answer is yes, then take action on that plan. And I think one of the great pieces of advice I've ever heard was like, if here's a challenge, quit something that is destructive in your life. And we can all find something, whether it's drinking, it's gambling, whether it's, I don't know, you know, eating junk food, and quit for a year. Just quit for a year. And then after that year, assess, is my life better without that thing in my life? Or is it worse? If it's worse, then put the thing back in your life. And if it's better, then quit doing that thing. And I think that kind of opened my eyes when I heard that piece of advice. And also recognize any patterns that you have. Like, for example, I have an addictive personality. Like I said, I'm a musician. So as a kid, and sometimes even still, I can just sit with my instrument for hours and not even realize that time has gone by. I'll lose track of time. And especially if I'm learning a new song, a new piece, or if I get involved in anything, especially even like housework right now, the whole day can go by and I feel like no time has gone by because I love learning new skills. So with drinking, I would have one drink and then I couldn't stop because it was like, okay, as soon as I opened a bottle of wine, I was like, okay, I have a glass. There's only 80% of the bottle left. How much longer till I have to open? Are there any other bottles that are in the house? You know, I had this, it's the same thing for me with eating like sweets, for example. Like if somebody opens up a bag of cookies or opens up like has a cake or a pie, I can't just have like one little taste of sweets. I still have to be disciplined in that area too. But I know this about my personality. I know this about myself. I know that sometimes in certain situations, I can't just have a little bit of something. But we have to weed out those things that are destructive to us. And we can't allow ourselves, we have to develop discipline. And that's a pretty big step, is recognizing patterns in your cycle, in your behavior. Am I lying to myself? Am I lying to others? And I guess the main thesis would be honesty and being honest with yourself. And I think if you're serious about making a change in your life, and if you're serious about making a change in your life, you have to be honest with yourself. And being honest with yourself is the most important thing you can do, because you're your own best friend. You're your own best friend, and you're the best friend you're ever going to have. as a human friend. I mean, I don't want to, if people believe in God or they believe in some higher being, then maybe they believe that that person, that is a better friend to them. But as far as humans go, no one's going to care about you no one's going to care about you more than you're going to care for yourself, because sure, you're with yourself, you know, 100% of the time. And take care of yourself as if you were taking care of a loved one. You know, you're going to, if you saw a loved one, you know, about to slam their hand with a hammer, well, you would tell them, you would do everything you could to stop them from doing it. You know, it's the same way with bad habits in ourselves. We have to take care of ourselves the way we take care of others. So I think honesty, changing of habit, and, you know, as far as in recognizing psychological patterns and giving yourself a finite amount of time to maybe stop drinking. A week maybe might be a good first step. A month might be a good first step. A year might seem kind of daunting to some people. That doesn't have to be a year. Right. You know, it can be instead of drinking 5 nights a week, it can be drinking 4 nights a week. You know, baby steps, small steps, and also removing triggers. I mean, I know friends who, hey, for me, it's not a problem. For me personally, it's not a problem to go hang out with other people and be around other people that are drinking because it doesn't tempt me. For others, it might be a huge temptation. I know people who have quit drinking and they can't even go, they don't go to a bar anymore. They don't [S2] Right. [S1] Go socialize anymore. They don't, you know, because socializing triggers wanting to drink. And maybe that's the place that they are at that moment, and that will change hopefully someday. But, you know, you have to recognize that there are triggers, and, you know, you have to also ask yourself, how important is it for me to stay sober? How important is it for me? What value do you put on that? What value do you place on that? How valuable is your sobriety to you? Because if it's not valuable, then you're going to slip back into it, back into drinking, fairly quickly. If it's valuable to you and it's something that you cherish like a treasure, then, you know, nobody's going to take that away from you. So those are all things. That certainly wasn't coherent or thought out. That was just sort of me talking, but I think those are the basic points. And that's what I would say is be honest with yourself.
Yeah. Well, and those are awesome points. And to, you know, you have your wife to go through it with and to talk about and to tell mm-hmm. stories about, and so do I, but, you know, I think, and this, you didn't mention it, but I think it's, you know, from listening to you speak about it, that's certainly been at least having somebody to talk to mm-hmm. About it and go through it with you together, whether it's one person or it's community or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. And that comes up over and over and over on this show is you've got to reach out to other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And finding a community, of course, but also, you know, like what you're doing, Bruce, is like you're using this podcast as a personal challenge, I think, to right. document, to interview people, and you're finding your community in this way. You're finding, you're using this podcast to hold you accountable. So it's finding something to hold you accountable, finding something to say to the world, this is what I'm doing. And please hold me accountable. Help me. Help me.
Accountability is important. Yeah.
Help me stay on the path. And I think it's great what you're doing with this, with your podcast. I have a lot of respect and I'm glad you're doing that.
Thank you. Yeah. It's definitely the secret's out. There's no more lying.
Yeah.
Well, Anthony, this has been an awesome hour, man. Thank you so much. You have an incredible story. I appreciate you coming on and, hang in there. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
All right. Take care, buddy.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Well, gang, there you have it. Anthony Garcia. What an incredible story. What an incredible man. And I'm telling you, an incredible musician. You guys owe it to yourself to check out his music. We'll talk more about that at the end of the show. Okay, here's the real life strategies that I heard from Anthony on getting and staying sober. First and foremost, ask hard questions. Are you ready to quit? What is it in my life that's damaging me? What's causing me to drink? And do what you need to do to get those things out of your life, whether it's psychiatric help, medical help, talking to a friend, talking to a counselor, talking to whoever. Figure out what it is that's causing the damage in your life and get rid of it. And be honest with yourself. As Anthony said, you're your own best friend. Nobody's going to love you more than you love yourself. Our theme music is by Anthony Garcia. Check him out at anthonygarciamusic.com. I'm Bruce Roberts. Thanks for tuning in.